Good afternoon. A warm welcome to the members and guests who are here today and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Mid-Coast Forum was founded in 1983. This is our 457th meeting with an invited speaker on an issue central to the conduct of U.S. foreign affairs. Please visit our website, midcoastforum.org, for audios of past forum talks and information about upcoming forum speakers. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, please consider becoming a forum member and attending our talks. You will find our membership form on the forum's website. We are pleased to have Mr. Thomas Ricks as our speaker here today. The topic of his talk is First Principles: What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Thomas Ricks is an American journalist and author who specializes in the military and national security issues. He covered the U.S. military for the Washington Post from 2000 to 2008. Until the end of 1999, he had the same beat at the Wall Street Journal, where he was a reporter for 17 years. While at the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Ricks was part of the team writing the Price of Power series, discussing United States defense spending and potential changes confronting the U.S. military following the end of the Cold War. The series won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. He won a second Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting as part of the Washington Post team for reporting about the beginnings of the U.S. counteroffensive against terrorism. Mr. Ricks has reported on military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He previously wrote a blog for foreign policy called The Best Defense, and he is a member of the Center for a New American Security, a defense policy think tank. Mr. Ricks lectures widely to the military and was a member of Harvard University's Senior Advisory Council on the project on U.S. civil-military relations. He is the author of several nonfiction books, including Making the Corps, published in 1997, the best-selling Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, published in 2006, and its follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, from 1906 to 1908, and that was published in 2009. In addition, he is the author of the best-selling book, The First Principles, the book he's going to talk about today, What America's Founders Learned About the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. And that was published in 2020. And Waging a Good War, How the Civil Rights Movement Won Its Battles, 1954 to 1968, and that was published just last year. Born in Massachusetts, Mr. Ricks grew up in New York and Afghanistan, and that should have been interesting, and graduated from Yale in 1977. Tom, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you all hear me out in the cheap seats? Good. Okay. It's a pleasure to be here in this toasty Maine summer. It really does make me glad we have books for summers like this. I have read more books in the month of June than I think any previous summer. I want to talk in the beginning here about the ancient world and the remnants of it that are around us. By that I mean the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. If you're someone who still uses cash, if you reached into your pocket and took out a dollar bill and you looked at the little pyramid that has the eyeball on top of it, what's that all about? There are two phrases of Latin. We all carry this Latin around in our pockets. We talk about two political parties, Democratic, a Greek word, and Republican, a Latin word from the Romans. We live in cities that some have names like Syracuse and Athens and Rome. Yet these often are not recognized. A lot of people don't know that the Capitol building, where the U.S. legislature sits and occasionally gets invaded, comes from the Roman. That the Senate is another nod to Rome. That across the street, the Supreme Court is built to look like a Roman temple. And at the other end of the Washington Mall, the Lincoln Memorial is essentially the Parthenon from the Greek Acropolis turned sideways. All of these things come from the Greeks and the Romans. That's because they are much more important to the people who founded this country and designed its government than they are to us today. When the founders sat down to design the government that we still live with, the Constitution, they looked around for examples. There were precious few. They had a lot of negative examples. They didn't want a monarchy. Well, aside from Alexander Hamilton, but that's another musical. They didn't want to have a powerful army that could depose a king and replace him, as had happened a century earlier in England. There weren't many modern examples to go by. There were Italian city-states that called themselves republics, like Genoa and Venice, but they really were not seen as republics. They were controlled by the rich. So, when they wrote the Constitution, when they sat down for a hot summer in Philadelphia to discuss it, they mainly looked to two things. First, the ancient Greek city-states, and even more, the Roman Republic. To them, that Roman Republic, its rise and its fall, was the central political narrative of all history. They all knew the stories, they all knew the histories, they all knew that if you called someone a Cicero, what that meant, or if you called somebody a Caesar, what a devastating insult that was. One example. The reason these days that tiny little states like Wyoming have two senators, even as large states like California and New York have two senators, goes back to how one Greek confederation of city-states was run. And I never get the pronunciation right because I can't find any Greek expert who tells me that we know that, but it's like amphixitonic. They all knew that phrase. James Madison, Little Jimmy, they called him, Little Jimmy Madison, about this tall, had spent a couple of years sitting in his parents' library in Montpelier, their estate in Virginia, reading every single document he could find on the structure of ancient Greek city-states and their confederations. And the leagues often had two representatives from each city-state, no matter how small or big it was. Madison, it's fascinating to me, he dove into this. He actually had Thomas Jefferson, then living in Paris, ship him cases of books in Greek and Latin that might give any evidence or whiff of how these ancient states were constructed. The more you read about Jimmy Madison, the more I'm fascinated by him. He was not a great phrase maker. We don't remember anything he really wrote in particular. But again and again, he's so important in designing America and persuading other people and getting it all together. I think probably the least appreciated of the founders. But not everything the founders learned from the ancients was helpful. From their study of the Roman Republic especially, they had one great, overwhelming, dominating fear. That was faction. Faction to them, what we would call party, was to them almost treasonous. They were taught, all of them in school, even the relatively undereducated George Washington, a man who learned by action, not by words. All of them knew, were taught in school, that faction led to the downfall of the Roman Republic and the rise of Julius Caesar and the destruction of the Republic to be replaced by monarchy. They all knew that's what they didn't want to have happen. That's all what they feared would happen when you started this new country. There were so few examples of successful republics, especially large successful republics. They knew it was a risk and a gamble. But the Constitution is designed almost as a strategic document. Let's see if we can hold this thing together. Let's take a risk and try to do it this way. But they were terrified of faction. Most of all, John Adams. Little John Adams succeeds Big George Washington as president. John Adams is kind of a whiner. He's kind of querulous. He's incredibly smart. He's incredibly honest. And as Franklin said, half insane. John Adams becomes president. He doesn't have the charisma or the war record that George Washington had. He becomes president and he says, these guys, especially Jefferson and Madison, are splitting things into faction, into parties. I gotta shut it down. Now, there were actually no formal parties at the time. What they really had was newspapers. So John Adams, as president, says, I know what I'll do. I will shut down the newspapers. He has 25 newspaper editors arrested at a time when there were not that many newspapers in America. He freaked out. Even when people from his own supporters criticized them, one Federalist judge in New York who criticized him, they clapped him in irons. Adams' view was you cannot criticize the president, because that will lead to faction and the downfall. Jefferson and Madison were a much cooler bunch about this. It's fascinating to watch that transition in 1801 of Jefferson taking the presidency from Adams. By the way, we recently in our history had a president who declined to show up at his successor's inauguration. The precedent for that was actually John Adams, who on the day that Jefferson was inaugurated caught the early coach to Baltimore and left town. But, and I gotta say this to John Adams' credit, he did turn over power peacefully to the opposition. There's a saying among historians that the test of a democracy is not whether you hold an election, it's whether you turn over power to the opposition when they win. And that was John Adams' great achievement. Despite all his instincts, he did turn over power to Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson gives up, and in the second best document he ever produced, his inaugural address says, everybody chill. Just because someone disagrees with you does not make them a traitor. And we're going to run the government like that. We're not going to shut down the opposition because we believe that if your views are true and correct, they eventually will prevail. Jefferson really establishes that tradition in his presidency. Why was Jefferson able to do this, coming out of this Roman tradition? Well, Jefferson is quirky. He's an oddity. Again, a little bit like John Adams, the more you know about Thomas Jefferson, the less you like him. But Jefferson is the oddball among the founders. They're all Roman. When they actually carve a statue of George Washington, they have him in a toga. And the noted art critic, Davy Crockett, when he saw the statue of Washington in a Roman toga, said, "That ain't right. He shouldn't be wearing a dress." Jefferson was no Roman. He was Greek. And in this, he was actually anticipating the 19th century Romanticism, less emphasis on the Romans, more on the Greeks. The great Greek tragedians were not seen as important world literature until the 19th century. But Jefferson, anticipating that, reads a lot of them in his youth and memorizes large chunks, I think especially of Sophocles. But even in his Greekness, he's unusual. At the time, they had a very different view of ancient Greek than we do. We now see Athens as the wonderful outpouring of wisdom and knowledge. In the 18th century, Sparta was seen as the more important, the better place, the more influential. Sparta were the people who got together and defended themselves. The Athens were described in the 18th century, the Athenians were described as a ship without a captain. Fractious, constantly arguing. Things that we like about them were seen as dangerous back then. As an Athenian admirer, Jefferson is also fascinating. He was an Epicurean. If you doubt this, go back and reread the Declaration of Independence, keeping Epicurus in mind. What does Epicurus say? The point of life is the pursuit of wise happiness. The Declaration of Independence is a document about happiness. It says it a couple of times. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which, by the way, was a rip-off of John Locke, who wrote Life, Liberty, and Property, or Estate. Jefferson says, no, we're not just about people who hold property, we're about anybody who is an American and who wants to pursue happiness. Not, you know, wild, crazy partying, but prudent, wise, informed, happy lives. Madison, working along with Jefferson, was almost another generation. Like Hamilton, Madison and Hamilton weren't so impressed by the ancient Greeks and Romans. They saw more of the flaws than the elders did. They're also both very influenced by Montesquieu, the French philosopher, who really invents modern politics in his writings. And takes a lot from Rome and the Greeks, but especially Rome, but reformulates it into a modern kind of state, how you would run a modern state. That really pours into the Federalist Papers, which becomes sort of the operating manual for how you run this new country. By the way, one of the fun things about writing nowadays is computerization and digitization of documents. Every single thing published in America in the 18th century is now online. Every single book, every single newspaper, every single pamphlet, most letters by public people, and even their diaries. As someone pointed out, we know a whole lot more about George Washington's inner life and thoughts than any of his contemporaries did. One of the things I could do, there's this great website called Founders Online, a joint project of the National Archives and the University of Virginia. One of the things I could do was design a search. How many times did all the founders refer in their writings to John Locke? How many times did they refer to Montesquieu? Well, guess what? They referred to Montesquieu about three times as much. What we were all taught in high school, that Locke was the most influential philosopher, I think was flatly incorrect. And that Montesquieu, the French philosopher had much more influence on how the founders thought about government. Quite why that mistake occurred, I don't know. One reason, by the way, though, that they refer to Montesquieu is, unlike most philosophers, both sides are using him. So that ups his numbers. And John Adams again. What was influencing him? What made this guy at once so honest, so brilliant, so querulous? John Adams is a relatively poor kid. Father is a good New England citizen, a selectman in a small town outside Boston, also a cobbler. They run a small farm, they grow cattle, and they fish, and they shoot ducks. Adams loves shooting ducks. Adams goes off to Harvard and becomes a school teacher in Worcester, Massachusetts. Like many people who go to Worcester, he hated it. And as soon as he could, he got himself back to Boston, became a successful lawyer, and rose up. More than anything, he set himself the goal of being the American Cicero. Who was Cicero? Cicero was seen in the 18th century as the greatest Roman statesman. Nowadays, he's kind of seen as a bit of a fathead. Kind of, if you watch the TV series Rome, he's always yakking on, but nobody's paying much attention to him. That is not the case in the 18th century. In the 18th century, he was seen as the greatest of the Romans, and in addition, seen as the artistic model of language. When they taught people how to write in the 18th century, they gave them the letters of Cicero to his friend Atticus, who lived in Greece, and said, write like this. They memorized the letters and passages of Cicero. What does that mean? Cicero, in his political career, pursued one thing more than anything else: stability. Cicero was all about stability. John Adams made that his goal. The problem was America was not a stable place. It was a fast-changing, evolving place. And so Adams kind of puts himself up against Jefferson and Madison, who are kind of saying, let's try this, let's try this, let's try that. And Adams essentially fails. As he noted bitterly and often in his bitter memoirs, he was the first one-term president. He was turned out by the people, and that stuck in his craw the rest of his life. So that's a basic summary of what these people were thinking. Where are we now? What did they give us? They gave us a lot. I would say, though, that one of the biggest mistakes they made, one of the worst things they left us, was slavery. Not only did they allow slavery to continue to exist, they wove it into the fundamental law of the land. They don't actually use the term slavery. They don't talk about race, but it's very clear what they're talking about: people in bondage. They left us a mess. Why did they do this? Because otherwise they would not have a nation. We know from the records of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia that South Carolina and Georgia both said, if there is a whiff of getting rid of slavery in this Constitution, we're out, we're walking. We'll go be independent. Now, little South Carolina and even tinier Georgia, that's not much of a worry. The problem was it could give foreign powers a foothold in America on the edge of the country. It would give England, France, or Spain a place to ally with. And these countries, South Carolina and Georgia, would be so small, so tiny, weak, and vulnerable, they would necessarily have to ally with a foreign power to exist. So the smart money says, to understand the Constitution, look at it as a strategic document, but also as a compromise. a way to move forward. Second thing about slavery is they took a much more benign view of American slavery than they should have. Why do I use that word, benign? Because they relied on the excuse that the ancient world had slavery. What they did not look at was that the ancient world system of slavery was quite different. Yes, it could be brutal. Yes, it could be cruel. But it was fundamentally different in that, first, slaves did have some rights. Slaves could petition the emperor. A slave could be freed, and it was very common to be freed. The children of a freed slave could hold office. It took a couple of hundred years for Americans to take on board the notion that former slaves or the descendants of former slaves could hold office in this country. So the biggest difference was that ancient slavery was not based on race. Anybody of any color could become a slave. Anybody of any color could hold slaves. Basically, it was seen as an effective misfortune. Someone had the misfortune to be taken captive in war, they became a slave. In fact, the word comes from Slav. The Slavic people from whom where a lot of Roman slaves came from. So the founders, using the excuse of the ancient world, wrote a system of race-based slavery into the Constitution. They basically took a pass on it, too hard. Less than 100 years later, the country fell into a civil war, had a lousy Reconstruction in which the South basically revised the outcome of the war. In the long run, the South won the Civil War. And we are still struggling as a nation with that result. So if the founders came back today, I think they would be profoundly embarrassed to see that the repercussions of slavery are still with us. Overall, what would they see today? After they got over that initial embarrassment, I think first they'd be pleased to see that the United States has held together. There wasn't a lot of evidence, as I said, for republics, especially large republics, to live more than a few decades. For that, we need to thank little Jimmy Madison. Madison loved this system of dispersal of power. Take power in the federal government, disperse it into three different branches. In the legislative branch, disperse it into two different houses. Spread power also out into the states. The result of this is if you can't make compromises, you're frozen. So Madison, looking at today's often our political gridlock, would say, that's a feature, not a bug. That's the way the system works. I think the framers, though, would also point back at us on several issues where we have dropped the ball, where we are not running the government the way they intended, the way they designed it. First of all, I think they would be chagrined by the relative passivity of the U.S. Congress, the legislative branch. In their discussions in Philadelphia, they expected, they assumed that the legislative would be the most energetic of branches. I think they'd be surprised and disappointed to see that it is not, that it has failed to firmly assert its role as the co-equal branch of government with the executive. What would shock them even more, almost universally, with the exception of a couple of the wealthy South Carolinians, is how money has come to dominate American politics, particularly in the last 40 years. They would be appalled by corporate financing of campaigns. They would hold it in contempt. It is the very definition of what they called corruption. money running politics. And Jefferson and Madison in particular would be upset by Wall Street's role in that. Jefferson was constantly worried about financiers' influence on politics. It's one reason he was so enthusiastic about moving the American capital away from Philadelphia in New York to some place relatively further south, away from corporate and financial executives. They explicitly did not design America to be an oligarchy, that is, rule by the rich few. Most of them would have seen the outcome that we were at now, in which rich people have a vastly disproportionate influence on American politics. They would see that as inconsistent with being a republic. It throws the system out of whack. They also would be puzzled by our current state of wealth inequality, in which the 1% are reaping vastly disproportionate shares of American wealth. I actually have a quote from cranky old John Adams on this. Adams wrote, quote, "Property monopolized or in the possession of a few is a curse. We should preserve not an absolute equality, that is unnecessary, but preserve all from extreme poverty and others, all others, from extravagant riches." He saw extreme poverty and extravagant riches as both undesirable outcomes and not what this country was supposed to have. Another area, I think, where they would be bothered and have an argument with us is how many Americans regard opinions as having equal standing to facts. Remember, these were people who come out of the Enlightenment, who believed in reason. The Enlightenment is in a nutshell. How would you define it? I would define it as the ability to weigh information, to examine reality, and to engage in rational inquiry and evidence-based debate. They really did not care a lot for opinions. They cared a lot for facts. Finally, what would they say about Donald Trump? This may surprise you. I think they would shrug. I think they would say, "Don't panic. We expected this. Our studies of ancient Greek and ancient Rome told us that sometimes this kind of things happen." They all held the view that every form of government can go bad, can go sour. So monarchy can become tyranny. Aristocracy can become oligarchy. Democracy can become the mob. That's one reason when they designed the government, they said, let's take aspects of all three of those things and try to balance them. So the monarchy is a little bit like the presidency. Aristocracy is supposed to be a little bit like the Supreme Court, and the democratic mob is the legislature. We actually know what they said about Donald Trump, though. James Madison wrote in the most famous of his contributions to the Federalist Papers, "Enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. The system they designed was designed to absorb the impact of bad people. They knew they were out there." They would say, "We expected this." Madison would say, "This is part of the system." And if James Madison came back and tried to write a history of the last couple of years, I would say, look, he would say, Donald Trump tried to introduce a retrogressive personal form of rule. Didn't work. He kept on running into this big block called the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution is built to foster the rule of law. over the last several years, we saw Madison's checks and balance operate robustly. Now, check is a term that doesn't been discussed much. Check in politics can be very rough. Think of a hockey check. Think of how Nancy Pelosi kept on shocking Donald Trump with checks. And he kept on saying, who is this woman? How is she doing this? I'm the king. And she kept on saying, you're not the king. And in fact, we have ways of dealing with you. Trump always seems to be surprised by that. I honestly doubt in my own heart whether he ever read the Constitution. As an aside, Trump's frequent attacks on immigrants would raise a few eyebrows among the founders. I think particularly of the 39 people who signed the Constitution, 7 were themselves immigrants, most notably Alexander Hamilton and James Wilson. Finally, what would the founders say about the coronavirus pandemic and how we reacted to it? Here, they actually write about it in the Constitution. The founders believed in what they called the general welfare, a phrase they used not once, but twice in the Constitution. It's in the preamble and Article 1, Section 8. They dwelled constantly on the question of how to promote what they called the public good. The public good, that phrase, occurs over 1,000 times in their writings. Just go to Founders Online, put in the public good as a phrase, in quotes, and you'll be amazed at how much they are arguing about it. With that in mind, the public good as the foremost goal of government and of good people supporting it, I suspect that some of them, not all of them, would tell Americans put less emphasis on property rights and more on the rights of the people as a whole. They would say we did not write this Constitution to let the market dominate who we are or how we live. The market is a good way to run business. It is not the definition of politics. If it were, we wouldn't have written the U.S. Constitution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we need once in a while to hear about how we started and how we've evolved to where we are now. It's been really, really excellent. I usually take the opportunity as a moderator to ask the first question. And you said that slavery was the issue that was too hard to do, and so it was put into the Constitution the way it was. Are there some issues now, given the current situation, that are just kind of too hard to do? Or are we in a, you know, they'd be amazed at the Republic still standing, but is it going to still be standing a few decades from now?
The issue that reminds me most of slavery nowadays is abortion. And especially in the way the Supreme Court has dealt with it. The Supreme Court watched the legislature, the Congress, for decades, and finally said, hey, we're going to step in here, we're going to intervene, I think it's 1854, and they issue the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision says, and I'm quoting here, the black person has no rights that the white Americans must respect. And they thought, bam, we have settled that once and for all. We just dropped a billion-pound bomb on them. And in fact, we now know that basically is one of the fuses of the Civil War. They thought they stated it so powerfully that the argument would be over. Instead, they stated it so powerfully that the other side said, okay, this means war. The way the Supreme Court has handled abortion recently reminds me of that. And some other issues. They basically said, we're going to smack down everybody and tell you what's what. And guess what? The American system doesn't work that way. What it does is the Supreme Court I think ultimately is going to provoke such a response. The other second thing, and it's kind of related, is guns. We have such a bizarre interpretation of the Second Amendment. We don't even interpret what it says. It says a well-regulated militia. I say you want to own a weapon in this country, be part of a well-regulated militia. That does not mean a militia of the whole, all the adult population, as the Supreme Court has interpreted it. We have a militia. It's called the National Guard. And I'm a big fan of the National Guard. I'm actually writing a book right now that gets into the National Guard a lot. The National Guard, I'm not saying you'd have to be in uniform. I'm saying you need to go down and get a card from the National Guard if you want to own a weapon in this country. And that begins well-regulated. Right now, we are totally out of whack with what the Second Amendment actually says.
Thank you. Somebody wants to know, is our citizenry as principled today as it was in the Republic's early years? Have we changed as the way we think about things?
I actually think our citizenry is probably more principled. You know, the more you read American history, the more you see there's a lot of bad people, rogues, villains, and so on. I mean, Aaron Burr nearly became president, committed treason, shot Alexander Hamilton. The guy was a piece of work. This is what happens if you go to Princeton. His father was president of Princeton, by the way. I really like Princeton. Princeton comes off very well in my book. It really was one of the great engines of the revolution in a way that other colleges weren't. The president of Princeton was the only minister to sign the Constitution. I believe he also signed the Declaration of Independence, John Wetherspoon. Go ahead.
I'm going to ask, you didn't mention religion as a component of the founder's vision. How does religion fit into all of this?
Religion doesn't loom very large. Now, other people think differently. John Meacham, who's a great writer, thinks that religion was important to them. I'm going by the evidence. These guys do not talk about religion a lot. The late 18th century, the numbers were surprisingly low on church attendance. They shoot up in the 19th century, partly because in the 18th century, religion was a wing of the government and as kind of a form of control of the people. You wanted to be a minister in New England, you had to have a college degree, that meant you went to Harvard, and then you'd go out and tell the yahoos how to behave. I mean, that's the way the system was. In Maine, the reaction to that is the growth of non-congregational churches like Baptist churches. And I still think about this whenever I drive through the backcountry, through Sheepscot, and all the towns with the political names, Union, Liberty, Freedom. There is a reason. Those people were anti-Congo church, anti all you bad people down on the coast. There's a reason Wiscasset had to build a stone jail, because the people from the interior came down and tore down the wooden jail. They also threatened to burn Belfast at one point because of property disputes between the rich coastal people and their lawyers in Boston and the interior people.
Well, we live out in the interior, so we still feel that.
I live on Deer Isle, which is like a coastal version of the interior. By the way, Peter Powers, the first congregational minister on Deer Isle, is mentioned in John Adams' diaries. They were friends at college at Harvard.
Several questions here on the inequality question, wealth inequality. How did the Romans and Greeks maintain an effective distribution of wealth, or did they?
The Romans did not maintain an effective distribution of wealth, and it was a constant political problem. The Romans didn't have a Federal Reserve or any central bank of any kind. The emperor's, basically his wallet was the reserve bank of the Roman Empire. And you go back and read Roman history, and constantly they're selling the emperor, whoever he is, you got to go out and spend a lot of money just to get the economy going again. The Greeks were better at it. The Greeks, first of all, didn't have a lot of respect for wealth, were very suspicious of it, and weren't particularly rich people. You don't get a lot of wealthy people in ancient Greece. And they kind of regarded it as untoward to devote yourself to gathering money. What you needed was enough to live decently. And you see that in sort of how Athens and most other city-states behave. The Spartans actually didn't like wealth. They suppressed wealth. They took away money. The Spartans were more or less, I don't know what the term for it is, but Spartan, a little bit totalitarian, very autocratic. They had all these weird rules where if you were a man of a certain age and your wife wasn't pregnant, other men had the right to petition her. They were all about the state needs babies. And if you ain't producing them, we'll find someone who does. Also, they really had a state support of homosexuality, and they had privileged it above heterosexuality in their military units. And so they constantly were looking for solutions. How do we get some babies around here?
So that was the Greeks and the Romans. How about today, in today's world? How could we redistribute the extreme wealth like that of Zuckerberg and Bezos?
Oh, I think it's time to tax the rich. The rich in this country have gained control of the political system and made sure they're not taxed. And they've written a tax code that basically means, as Warren Buffett says, Warren Buffett's secretary pays a greater percentage of her income in taxes than he does. And he's a very large billionaire. This is what happens when money controls politics. People with money control how much they're taxed. I'm not a big fan of Bernie Sanders, but I think he's absolutely correct when he says these days that Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress.
This one's a little bit different. The Founding Fathers did not incorporate any term limits into the Constitution. Why not, and what role do you see for
term limits? Is interesting because they were going in the opposite direction. Alexander Hamilton, I'm fond of. And actually, I think the musical about him is quite good. They get Madison wrong, but they get Hamilton pretty right. Hamilton shows up and he says, okay, fellas, in Philadelphia, he gives this two-part speech, 3 hours each part, and says, here's what you're going to do. The presidency will be for life, and so will the senators. So it's the opposite of term limits. He said this will ensure stability, and people won't be kowtowing. Politicians won't kowtow to the people because they're in power and they won't be giving it up. They're actually, the discussions of the Constitutional Convention are fascinating. It's not trivia. At one point, they're saying, the presidency, this thing, the executive branch, how many people should be in the presidency? Should it be one, two, or three? They say, well, if it's three, well, then we saw it. That didn't work well in Rome when they had triumvirates. They ended up going to war with each other. If it's two, there'd be a constant nagging back and forth. So let's just make it one. And that was like one afternoon's discussion, and then they went out for beers. They just made that decision. And there's constantly decisions like that. I actually think term limits on the Supreme Court, maybe 15 or 18 years, would have been intelligent and would have fit their expectation back when most people didn't live much beyond 65 or 70. I mean, the prospect of now appointing somebody who's 40 and having them sit on the court for 50 years was not something they had considered. So I think 18 years on the Supreme Court, one term, and then you go back and serve as an appellate judge or whatever, would be a much better solution.
Let me follow up for a second on the Supreme Court comments. And someone has a question here. What would the Founding Fathers say about the performance of the Supreme Court and the regard in which it's held today? I mean, term limits aside, is this, again, just something they'd come back and say, yeah, the Supreme Court acts that way?
My personal belief is the Supreme Court probably was a mistake. That there's something basically flawed about its entire design. But the Supreme Court today actually is probably held in much more esteem than it was early in America until John Marshall comes along and kind of shores it up. I mean, does anybody know who Ellsworth, Maine, is named for? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he was a bum. Not particularly good. I think it was Oliver Ellsworth. I believe he was the second Chief Justice after John Jay, if I recall correctly. The Supreme Court didn't do a lot, didn't have a lot of power, and wasn't much listened to early on. The Supreme Court builds itself up terrifically in the 19th century and has passed some screwy laws, like the fact that you can't demonstrate outside a Supreme Court justice's house that it's illegal. I think that's nuts. I mean, there's a thing called the First Amendment. You can peaceably gather to tell the government you don't like what they're doing.
Yes. So you said that when the Founding Fathers came back, they'd be amazed, might be amazed that the Republic still exists, might think that Donald Trump is just kind of was to be expected. But do they think that we're on the right path now? That if everything's just going to, you know, settle back down again, or would they see a revolution coming? Or what do you think they would see?
The one I channel best is James Madison. And I think Madison would say, system's working. You know, it's got ups and downs. What really gave me this reassurance was, oddly enough, January 6th. When January 6th, the invasion happened, we were at home on Deer Isle. And I was just stunned. This was the worst possible outcome. The president encouraging the actual stoppage of the workings of Congress by a mob that was attacking police and chasing the vice president and other people out of the building. And then when we saw the tapes that came out, I believe, almost exactly a month later, oddly enough, I was supposed to speak that night at Bowdoin. And I think it was February 6th, and the tapes of the invasion actually were released that day. And I remember I sat down and said to my wife, I can't give a speech tonight. This is like the collapse of the Republic. And we didn't know at that point what was going to happen. But since then, two things have happened that have really given me hope. Number one is the vigorous response of American law enforcement. These people who invaded the Capitol thought law and order was for other people, especially minorities. And what they said, law and order, what they meant was keep down the black people and other people of color. They were really surprised to find out it applied to them. And this has been a real wake-up call to the American right. We can get arrested for slugging cops? Wow! And the second thing is, they didn't have the courage of their convictions. I just finished writing a book after this one, Waging a Good War. And the contrast between January 6th and the Civil Rights Movement, to me, is this. The people in the Civil Rights Movement had the courage of their conviction. They were willing to go to jail for their beliefs. In fact, they asked to go to jail for their beliefs. And in fact, many people in the Civil Rights Movement refused to offer bail. They said, if you think I'm wrong for what I've done, I'm going to stay here in jail. They had the courage to stand up for their convictions and to pay the price of violating the law. This was civil disobedience. They were following Gandhi. The January 6th people meant no such thing. They said, no, don't put us in jail. They were stunned to be put in jail and a little bit chagrined to find they were treated like other people in jail. The food here stinks, they said. What did you expect? There's a reason that jail is not a comfortable place to be. They didn't like it at all. And so the way that the January 6th movement just evaporated gave me real hope that this country was working the way that James Madison had hoped it would and the way they envisioned.
One final question then before we quit, and that is, you mentioned that compromise was a big element in both in creation of the Constitution, but also in what was built into the system. We don't seem to be having much compromise. We get farther and farther, the sides get farther and farther mm-hmm. apart. Is there a way through that to get the compromise back into the government?
I think there is. I mean, I'm not a big, huge fan of Joe Biden, but he is a man who is a creature of the U.S. Senate, and he's totally about compromise. And he's very good at compromise, and I think he's been a surprisingly effective president, much more than I expected, both on foreign policy and a domestic policy, on the economy, because of that basic belief and compromise and willingness to compromise. I'm just going to say about Joe Biden, I really encountered the guy twice in my life. When I was in college, I had dinner with him. And then 40 years later, as a reporter, I interviewed him. Both times, I asked him one question. He yakked for 50 minutes and didn't say a single thing. But as president, as a candidate for president and as president, he's shown much more discipline. This is the one thing that gives me hope for this notion of an 80-year-old guy running for president. He sure learned late in life how to shut his trap.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.